Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly talk show. I'm Chris McCormack, Associate Editor at the magazine, and today I'm joined by Elizabeth Fullerton, who has written an extensive report on the current art scene in Tallinn, Peter Sutcheon, who has reviewed the current show of Barbara Stubini at Modern Art Oxford, and Henry Broom on the complex relation between art and gentrification. But first, we start with writer and curator Rachel Pronger, who has reviewed Vaginal Davis's retrospective Magnificent Product at Gropiusbau in Berlin, which toured from Moderna Museet in Stockholm. To many, Davis is a countercultural commentator and provocateur, but for those less familiar with her work and output, and I imagine that many people, certainly in the UK, probably haven't come across many of Vaginal Davis's works, I wondered if we might begin with a brief overview of her career and a kind of character, who
Yes.
she is, and a kind of like a sense of where she sits in terms of America and American culture, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So Vaginal Davis is an LA-born, Berlin-based artist. She's someone who is, I would say, extremely good at describing herself. She's very good at kind of giving you like a pithy mission statement. So one way that she's described herself, which I find quite enjoyable, is as an internationally revered intersex doyenne of intermediate arts and sciences, which gives you a sense of her tone. She started out in the sort of grubby DIY music and film scene of Los Angeles and was very much part of the kind of the sort of underground bands of that moment, played in a series of bands of excellent names, made a series of kind of provocative and fun video works during that period. And then in the early noughties, she moves to Berlin, where she has become a real fixture of the Berlin art scene. And I would say potentially her impact in Berlin now is stronger than her impact in LA in terms of she feels very much at home here.
That's
And
interesting.
she's moved here and kind of slotted into Berlin's famous grubby, glamorous, grotesque, queer art scene, where she's very much a kind of central figure. The kind of work she produces is a mixture of performance work, paintings, drawings, written work, sculptures, installations. She really creates everything. And she's also someone who inhabits art in the way that she lives her life. She's kind of a walking art piece in her own right. And she's also well known here as a curator, which I'd like to flag as well. She does a lot of work curating silent film and as a film historian. So she's really an incredibly multi-talented and fascinating figure.
Oh, that's amazing. I did not know that about her, actually. She did curating, certainly silent film. That's fascinating. I guess my memory, I remember Vaginal Davis in London performing at some clubs in the early aughts. Yeah, I guess that's my memory of her. So it's kind of fascinating to for me to see or to even imagine how this came about, really, a retrospective and how this pulled together all this body of work, really. Can you give a sense of how the show opens and how they kind of, I suppose, fitted in all his works into the Gropiusbau?
So if you're familiar with the Gropiusbau building, then you'll know that it's quite a grand sort of stately building. It's got lots of kind of gold and marble. It's a very kind of fancy looking building. And it has a quite vast cavernous ground floor arranged around a central sort of square in the centre. And the Vaginal Davis exhibition unfolds around the square. So you kind of, it's very much like you enter into a journey. So you enter through the entrance of the exhibition, and you're greeted with this sort of preliminary space where you have a few of these quite tiny, quite delicate, kind of crude, but also sort of elegant in their way, paintings that Vaginal Davis has made of some of her heroines, basically. And this little kind of foyer section of the exhibition encapsulates in miniature the sort of incredibly wide-ranging cultural appetite that Davis has. So you're greeted in this opening section by portraits of figures ranging from the experimental filmmaker Maya Duran, the writers Harper Lee and Zora Neale Hurston, the philosopher Hannah Arendt, and the German actress Hannah Schygler. But you also have a picture of the cult US TV star Diz McNally, who is painted with flaming hair and a glittery silver nose. And this gives you a sense of the playfulness that we're about to see in the exhibition. And there's also a series of tiny portraits of like Tudor style, kind of, I think one of them is of Anne Boleyn. So there's like a very much a sense of this is someone who loves history, loves culture, loves high and low arts. So then you go past this kind of entry section into the main exhibition. And the exhibition unfolds in a series of installations that are each sort of based on a period of Reginald Davis's life. So again, there's a feeling of you're entering into a journey into Davis's brain. So we start off with this kind of section, which is titled Naked on My Osgood, Bossed House Anal Deep Throat. There's a lot of names like this that are really
Right.
challenging to say out loud,
Well,
but again,
something
very
challenging, let's say, for
playful.
some audiences, let's say
Yeah.
that.
I mean, my main issue is I don't know how to pronounce Osgood. I have no idea how to say
Yes.
that. But this is quite funny. So this section of the exhibition is inspired by Frank L. Baum's Oz series. So obviously Wizard of Oz is the famous
Yeah.
one, but there's 13 Oz books. But also Davis claims that the exhibition, this installation, is something that she originally mounted as a child in an LA library. It was like her first childhood exhibition inspired by Oz. So here we see it reimagined through the inevitable eyes of, queer culture, because Oz is an incredibly important queer text as well,
Yeah.
significant queer text. And you have a series of these little tiny sculptures of Frank L. Baum's weird little characters. Some of them seem to have giant phalluses or various kind of slightly provocative titles and poses.
Yes.
Everything's quite sparkly.
Yeah.
Things are presented beautifully on like little velvet cushions. So, and there's also drawings all over the walls, like scrawled kind of childlike drawings. So again, completely fantastical, childlike, playful, funny, filthy, which
But
is totally
ultimately
its
quite a
own.
subversive way of
Yeah.
rendering it through kind of other provocative, as you say, provocative imagery. Is there through, I mean, this is kind of, I don't, I mean, I'd be interested to know, is there arcs or movements in Davis's work that sort of sits in different as or different parts of culture or different aspects of culture that
So
have
I would
been
say that absolutely. I would say that the way the exhibition is organized, it also takes kind of elements of her practice in turn. And by doing so, you get these little spotlights on cultural movements. So for instance, there is a section which is basically a mini cinema and a bar, which is called the Carla du Plantier Cinerama, this installation. And this section, you go into a dive bar, which is framed with posters of Davis's various bands that she was in at various times. My favorite is Cholita, which is a fictional Latina girl band where the members never age beyond their quinceañeras, so they're just always teenagers playing in this girl band, basically. So she has various fantastical punk bands like this, basically, that she was part of. And then you go into the cinema and you watch some of the kind of DIY films that she made. But that section is very much about LA's kind of late 80s, early 90s underground scene. So although it's her practice and it's all seen through the filter of her eyes, you get a sense here of a very particular cultural moment that they're trying to kind of viscerally capture with the scene setting of these different areas. And again, kind of in a related way, there's a section which is about her collaborations with the Berlin collective Cheap. I don't know if you say Cheap or Cheap, it's always in capitals. I never know with that. But here, this is very much a room that is about her entry into the Berlin scene of the early noughties. And I would say also in all these sections, you see a lot of different people who are associated with Vaginal Davis, because she's someone who moves in scenes and kind of creates scenes around herself, but also arrived in scenes at various times. So there's also a sense of it being quite a collaborative exhibition, even though it's very much all filtered through Davis's very unique perspective.
I mean, you get the sense that ultimately, I mean, she's an incredibly charismatic and wonderful person. And you can see how she's attracted huge amounts of people to her. So it's great to hear that actually this show represents something of that, as you point out, the sort of collaborative or networked way in which she kind of builds a kind of career through it. I guess also to think about.
Yeah, so for sure, there's a lot of archival material in terms of there's a lot of documentation as well. There's a lot of archive images, archive zines, this kind of thing as part of the exhibition. And there's also a lot of recreation, which can make it quite hard to tell when you go around what is work that is kind of being recreated and what is work that comes from her personal archives.
I
That's also a
see.
bit of a blur.
Yeah.
But there are also, and it's also a little bit difficult to tell sometimes, how far she's altered work she's done originally to recreate it in the space. Almost all the work is kind of has 1 year and then 2024 or 2025 on it. So there's a sense that she's always speaking across her own history, if you see what I mean. She's always incorporating old and new elements into every piece. One piece that I really liked that I would like to flag is there's a room which is based on Hag, which is small contemporary Haggard, the kind of art space that she created in LA. So this is a recreation of, apparently, it's again hard to know sometimes with Davis what's myth and what's reality, but I'm just going to take it at face value. So there's an art space that she created in LA in the kind of early noughties, which she then recreates here. But here it's built as a black box in the center of the gallery that you walk into, which is like a tiny space that you walk into with a tilted floor. So it's super disorientating. You walk into it, it's lit with pink neon light from the inside. And then the walls are covered in an installation that she calls lesbian domesticity wallpaper, which is a series, yeah, so many great names, which is a series of kind of childlike women's faces, like sad women's faces, scrawled with like very big coal-lined eyes, huge eyelashes. And then there's also two bread sculptures, which are named after Mariah Carey and Justin Timberlake.
Of course.
Of course, why not? And that piece I think is quite is really funny and maybe speaks a bit to this kind of blur because I get the impression that she did exhibit some of this work in Hag, but then she's created Hag as its own artwork within a gallery again. So it's kind of like, what is it now? Like, what has she created now? Is it a historical piece or a new piece? And yeah, it's and I just it's also funny as well. And the logic of it is just so enjoyable to try and follow at the
I
same time.
guess if we can try and point to something, I mean, I think the genuine sense of enjoyment and pleasure and humor and but also within that, I guess we have to address something of the politics that sit within the work too. And maybe it's great to kind of also bring some of that into line. What is maybe some of the broader politics around what Vaginal Davis is doing here? Because it's quite clear, but also she's doing it in these very deceptively, I would say, sugar-coated or playful ways. So maybe that's kind of an interesting way to talk about work too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, so I think there's a very strong parallel between Vaginal Davis and Lee Bowery in terms of artists who are roughly contemporaneous and very important queer artists working within particular urban scenes. But also, as I said earlier, people who live their art and maybe you question a little bit how where the art starts and the person begins, how much performing your art is a political act. And I think that there is very much the element of with Vaginal Davis, I feel like it's about declaring visibility of being a Black, Latina, queer, femme artist working, you know, in a time that is incredibly, I mean, it's right now is incredibly hostile to all of those elements of identity, right? And there have also been many times in history where we've also seen these spikes of hostility towards each of those identities. You know, you can't ignore the fact that she's working through the AIDS epidemic, all these things you have to take into account. And I think the politics lies in, despite these clear elements of marginalization, being so bold and so visible and so continuously joyful in the art feels very political in itself. And obviously, I think questions around gender and sexuality and race are really woven into the very fabric of the art that she produces. I mean, you look at some of the DIY videos, for instance, are very much talking. One of them is about abortion access, for instance, but it's dealt with in a way where it's someone, it's a character having a kind of phantom pregnancy, and it's played with in a very kind of playful, quasi-magical, childlike way. And for me, I think that's part of what makes it so powerful as a political message is it's saying we can have joy and humor even in very dark topics as well. So yeah, I found that very powerful. And like I said, I think a very strong parallel with Lee Bowery, someone else who lived outrageously and loudly, despite many, you know, a lot of hate coming his way as well, and a lot of difficulty in his life.
That's
So that feels powerful to me.
I think what's great about just Vaginal Davis is this capacity to disarm what are, as you say, very loaded, potentially loaded, and kind of let's say even squeamish for some people to even consider these lives existing, and also having the audacity to actually articulate themselves And I think it's that kind of the way which she spins that that actually creates such success in the work. So I guess I'm just agreeing with you. I'm asking you a question.
And I should also, I really feel like it's so hard not to just talk about every single element of the exhibition in loads of detail. But I mean, I have to say that the centerpiece of the exhibition, which is in a lot of the publicity photos or at least reviews that I've seen as well, is she's created a child, like a teenage girl's bedroom, which is beautiful, pastel pink, kind of like a 1950s sort of girl's bedroom, hung with movie star posters. And in the bed in the center of the installation is a light, like a human-sized dildo, which is in the revolving beds. And when I look at that, I'm like, I don't know what the content of this is necessarily, but I really like it. Like, it's just really fun to look at. It's really bold. And I think there is something about saying, like, I will not apologize for my sexuality, for my filthiness, for my potty mouth, like all of these things. It's so loud and outrageous. But it never feels nasty. It's got a kind of a sort of sincerity to it, and almost like a goodness to it, like almost a purity, as pure as you can ever have a revolving dildo in a bed.
What a
Like,
wonderful
it just
image.
works really well.
Thanks so much, Rachel, for that quick roundup of Vaginal's work. I actually, sounds joyous, and I certainly will go and see it over the summer. And obviously, I urge listeners to attend and also read Rachel's review in this month's issue. Many thanks again, Rachel, for your words.
Thank you.
Okay. And now I'm joined by writer and art critic Henry Broom, who is currently living in Lisbon. His feature, Artificial Local Colour, looks at the processes of gentrification and the ways in which art functions as a way to help smooth its running. We've obviously covered this subject many times in the past, including previous articles from you on it, Henry, but there seems to be an increasing instrumentalization of art for the sake of dressing up an area, rather than presenting anything that might represent or hold the interests of a community or area into focus. And I guess that's the kind of backdrop for which your article, I think, comes out of. And I just thought, is that really where you were observing that and thought this is what led you to write this article?
So it really comes out of a feature I wrote a while back for Ebb magazine. And that was focused on the Line sculpture trail, which runs from Stratford all the way down to Greenwich. I wrote something for Ebb about like the ways that the material of the sculpture reflects like the materials of the development. So like you've got Ish Kapoor's orbit sculpture, and that's a sculpture that uses the same steel that development uses. Well, and then I walked that sculpture trail, and it ends in Greenwich Peninsula, and that's an area that has just so many colourful sculptures. And then once you see that, like, you see it in developments in Canary Wharf, all across the city, basically. And Battersea Power Station is another example. And the same artists crop up, and it's, they're using these very, very colourful aesthetics to really like imbue these very soulless, sterile environments with some life. And cultural vitality. But they're also kind of like stand-ins for the black and brown working class people that have been either displaced or excluded from these areas. There are kind of like a sign of absence as well.
How to describe it? To me, it just seems incredibly thin. And kind of vacuous, these kinds of dressing up. I just consider it to be sort of about the entire, I mean, you called it artificial local color, and it is about that in a way. It's just this kind of very thin veneer of color being applied to kind of, imply some sort of, as you said, life, but actually maybe all of that is gone, or been drained away.
There's a sort of like design art movement called the New London Fabulous movement, And it's kind of like spearheaded by Adam Nathaniel Furman. And he wrote about it in a 2020 Dazine article. And it's supposed to be, he talks about color and public art as being sort of like highly aesthetic, sensual, celebratory of mixed cultures, and also references campiness as well. And there's like an extent to which these works are pointing towards marginalized communities, but in a very like vague way. And in many ways, like the color itself is a kind of like floating signifier where it can mean lots of different things. So everything and anything, but also at the same time, kind of like nothing at all. And I think that's why the property developers latch onto it, because it kind of like it's suggestive of diversity inclusion. But yeah, in the very real way, it's these developments are exclusionary. Like I started to read Anna Minton's book. What is the title of that? Ground Control. And he talks about Canary Wharf and how people in the Isle of Dogs, for example, in the long shadow of the banking HQs, they feel very excluded from these areas, and they actually feel kind of like, it sort of like disturbs them. One hairdresser that Minton mentions in the book says, "I don't like going to Canary Wharf. It always gives me the fear." So these places are kind of like very strange, and there's a sense in which like certain people are not welcome, even just to visit. But certainly in terms of the housing as well, like there's no real offering of affordable housing. Like these places are built for basically property speculation. That's essentially it.
Yeah, and you talk about the nature in which the percentages of affordable housing that these developers offer is increasingly winnowed out through the process of making. I mean, I think we know that, we can see these numerous new builds that happen across the city, and very few are going into the hands of anyone that has lower incomes or is, first time buyers, etc. And I guess the consequences of that are, real for many people's lives. It's not just, we can't afford, and certainly for people in the art world, who, don't get paid a huge amount of money either. The idea of, purchasing or even having any kind of access to these kinds of properties is hard to picture. But it's interesting in a way you point to this kind of, I guess what you could say, the paradox or the kind of inherent thing about how art is then, it's used to decorate it, but can very rarely actually then anyone be living in it who is an artist, I suppose. It's an ironic
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're basically with most councils, I think the target for affordable housing is 35%, but the developer can knock that down and argue the percentage down on the basis that it affects their profit margin, basically. So in the case of Greenwich Peninsula, they only offered 11% of the 17,000 units. And of course, that's like directly affecting people in that area who are struggling to buy houses. And yeah, as you're saying, like these basically like the same methods through which affordable housing is sort of negotiated with developers, the Section 106 agreements. That's, a kind of deal between the council and the developer whereby they agree to offset any kind of disruption caused by the development. And that would be by providing schools, park spaces, or public sculpture, or even affordable housing. And so, like, there's always this like damage limitation going on whereby the developer will, build this luxury property development, but at the same time, they're trying to do like remedial measures through public art or through affordable housing. And like these concerns always come after the fact, you know, they're not presented at the start of a project. So I guess that's the key, like, demand for the housing that, you know, affordable housing shouldn't be an afterthought, should be.
You know, also you talk about New York and the High Line, and in a funny sort of way, at least I think the High Line, I agree with you in terms of its place in gentrification. Yet it's still one of the few that, in fact, to me, has some examples of showing at least some good art on it. I think maybe one of the redeeming aspects of the High Line. Do you want to think a little bit about how you see this model sitting alongside the UK or anything like that?
Which model? Sorry.
The High Line, or you know, these kinds of other kinds of art initiatives.
Okay, yeah, sure. So the High Line was designed by the same firm that did a raised walkway also in Greenwich. And that very same firm will do a raised walkway that will go through Camden. And yeah, this sort of like these like raised walkways become ever more like prevalent in cities. But I mean, they're not particularly new. Martha Rosler, in her book, If You Lived Here, she talks about these raised walkways as sort of emptying cities out of any sort of like excitement and cultural vitality, so that the developers can come in and say, well, this area needs development. It's lacking, you know, any kind of like vibrancy. So, I think I reference it in the article. There's a New York Times piece on the High Line, and it says it was another chapter in the story of New York City's transformation into Disney World, a catalyst, some of the most rapid gentrification in the city's history. I think, yeah, obviously Greenwich is slightly different because, you know, it was Europe's largest gas works. So it was a kind of tabula rasa that, you know, became VO2. And then their sort of housing started to crop up. And so, yeah, you could argue that it was bringing, you know, development to a place where there was nothing beforehand. But again, there was no provision for like working class people. It's very much development for the wealthy, basically. And that's kind of where the article ends up. It's like, how could you imagine development for marginalized people? Because it's not that, in my view, people don't want to have, you know, like a swimming pool or new housing, good quality housing stock. But they don't want to be pushed out. And I think that public art can offer somewhat of a vision of these alternate futures. I look at Greenwich Mural Workshop's in Charlton, and yeah, essentially, like it's a mural on Floyd Road, and it pictures residents defeating council plans to knock down their streets. So in this mural, there is a painting of residents pushing back diggers, and also sort of replacing window sashes and doing upholstery. And so it's this idea of sort of like communal flourishing, but from the bottom up, not sort of imposed upon them through, you know, extractive developers. And I actually visited the mural to get a picture of it, because there are images on Google Maps, but sort of 2, 3 years out of date. And I went there, and the house on which the mural sits, the door was left open. So I rang the doorbell, and someone came to the door, a woman in her 70s, and she'd been living there for 30 years. And we started talking about the mural, and she said actually that, every few years people used to come and repaint the mural, but now it's been left and it's very, very tacky. And she actually said she doesn't like it, and it's a sort of like eyesore. So
Right.
it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that what for me is a sign of like communal upliftment is for her, almost devaluing her house.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? The inherent, yeah, these kind of contradictions that, on the surface appear to be one thing, but actually for the lives of those around also can be something entirely different. Great. Well, thanks so much for your time. And again, I urge readers to pick up a copy of this month's issue and read Henry's take on this subject. Many thanks. And now I'm joined by the writer and critic Peter Sutcheon, who has reviewed the exhibition of Barbara Stavini's work, I Find Myself, currently on show at the Modern Art Oxford until June 8th. For many, Stavini's work is viewed through her time running the Artist Placement Group, and this exhibition attempts to reveal perhaps the breadth of her practice over those years. I wondered if we could begin by outlining the sense of the expansive way in which she worked and the way in which the curators here attempt to draw some definitions through it.
Right, well, it's quite a complex exhibition to look round, and I spent about 2 hours looking around it, and I didn't manage to read all the material in it because it's got a lot of objects in it that obviously one can look at fairly quickly. It's got a lot of documents, quite a huge amount really, and then various things that have been done by Anne Bean and other collaborators, as they call them, where Barbara Stavini's objects that she collected have been dug out of the archive and hung in the gallery and had film or video projected onto it. So a kind of modern artwork, contemporary artwork, is made using part of her artwork. So it's quite a range of things. And then one very big strand within it is a biographical strand about Barbara Stavini herself.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned
Okay,
in a
so
sense
that's
the
a rough
sorry.
outline. I don't know if that really gives the
It
full.
does, yeah. I mean, you mentioned in a way the somewhat hagiographic tone, I suppose, that some of the exhibition kind of yields to. And I guess you see that as sort of a limiting factor in terms of how the exhibition comes together.
Yeah, well, I thought they were trying to do too many different things within the exhibition, and that there's a lot of what you might call, and I mean this actually in a good way, contradictions in her practice, or competing strands or parallel strands. And I thought they were, in a way, trying to push the Barbara's a great artist, really, if only it was known, if only it could be seen. So I didn't feel they needed to push the biography too much. Because I see the PG as a group project. So to push an idea of an artist being like the brains behind it all or something, I thought it was a not a really necessary not a necessary thing to do, but that's what they were doing. Whether that's an institutional thing where the museum wants it to be more like audience friendly, it could be something like that. I don't know how that came about.
And in terms of then how the work show, say for
I
instance,
mean, I found it in. I mean, what?
I was going to ask in terms of the work that she produced or sort of did or run through the kind of artist placement group, how is that presented or shown in this exhibition?
Well, it starts off with her own work. I mean, individual artworks like collages, assemblages, which have a kind of Kurt Switters-like look or composition. And then there's things like suitcases that she much didn't make the suitcase, but she made little mini installations in suitcases. So it's got about half a room of objects that she actually made. And then it kind of goes in. Into or goes on to the APG stuff, and then it gets much more like a kind of documentary type show rather than here are the objects or here are some objects. And then there's, as I said a minute ago, there's quite a lot really of stuff. If you wanted to read it, you could spend all day reading through all this transcripts, and there's photographs of APG meetings, and there's documentation a bit about people associated with it. And there's a couple of videos. So I thought it was kind of comprehensive. I thought it was very, very good. But I kind of wish they didn't. This biography thing annoyed me a bit. Yeah, also, well, as soon as you go in the exhibition, the first thing you see on the wall, apart from a text panel saying, you know, welcome, here's the exhibition, are two boiler suits that the artist wore when she was making her work. And it's like, oh, it's like the artist's smock or something. I thought, what's this got to do with anything except to say she's a worker? It seemed unnecessary. We know already from what she did that her contribution was not just to that group, but to 1960s art was pretty significant. So I felt it was like harping back to a role as model of the artist, an old-fashioned model of the artist as a special person, getting their hands dirty. And I didn't really, it seemed like a backward step, as opposed to saying this is a group practice, and that's a kind of new thing in the 60s, other groups like Art and Language, and I think I mentioned in the review, it's called now, the famous conference in 1966 organised by Gustav Metzger.
Yeah, the description where all in these Art different Symposium.
Radical artists from around the world joined Kensal. That's it, yeah, destruction in art. So there's, on the one hand, there's this sort of opening up to a future of group practices where the individualism of the artist is played down, but at the same time, it's like there's this huge wadge of stuff that implies she's a very special person, like the role of the artist. So it seems like they can't make their mind up.
Yeah.
The curators can't really make their mind up which model of the practice they're going to push.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I think I said it, I suppose it's trying to be comprehensive. So in that sense, it's, sorry. Yeah, it's a sort of paradox. They want, there's paradoxes and contradictions and diversity within the practice, but they seem to try and make it that kind of going, it's almost as if they're going to forget about all this. Let's remember she was an important artist in her own right. And I think the whole, my impression of the APG is they were against that model of the special person. Mm. Although when they did their thing and they send Stuart Brisley or whoever into a factory, there's still a kind of trace, I suppose, of here's some specially trained fine art person going in to reimagine their lives or whatever went on when they were. So the more I read about, I mean, I've been reading it, it's a lot. I mean, it's a very interesting book, I think, with different essays. But the more I read it, the more I think the APG didn't read. The more I look at the literature in the handbook that comes with the show, I think it's a very interesting set of essays. But the picture I get through reading it carefully is that the APG really didn't move. Arguably didn't move that far away from the idea of the artist as a special person with a kind of esoteric set of knowledges or practices going into a non-art context and then doing their thing. Yes. On the one hand, it's a collaboration with the non-art world, but on the other hand, it's still sending in a kind of expert. So I think that model of the artist is, that old model of the artist is partly challenged, but not really moved away from. I'm not saying this is, I'm not criticizing them. I think it's quite Sabini. So Catherine Jackson is an academic. There's some material from Barbara Sabini herself. There's an interview with Tony Benn, the politician, or a discussion between Sabini and Tony Benn. Right. Then there are David Harding, who set up the famous Glasgow political art school practice. And then there are people like, I can't find her names now, but the people who archived her work. Okay. So Stavini's already got this massive amount of materials in her house, and the people who archived her work to put it into the Tate. So there's a strand of archiving in this book, which is very interesting as well. And it's very, very, I found the catalogue more interesting than the work in a way. I mean, the work is very well helped by accounts of how it was made and why it was made.
And in terms then, because you say in a way that the exhibition functions as an archive, maybe say something about how that appears to you, because in a way, I think of Stavini, and I can think of obviously her work in the APG group, and then some maybe elements of her practice as a painter. But in a way, like I consider these to be somewhat, I guess, from my perception, these seem quite disparate practices. How do they tie together, or how do they become part of the same form in terms of, is that through the
Well,
archive?
it's almost like, yeah, I think it is through the archive because really it's, as well as being a load of stuff, if you like, it's put together in I suppose you could call it a narrative or a chronology. So it starts, so all the, I think the painting she did and the collage stuff is all, if you like, early work before APG and before the group, well, I nearly said aesthetic, but mentality took over. So that's what I mean about they're doing several things with the show. They're saying here's a like a track, the track of her life from, in inverted commas, ordinary artist to APG, sort of avant-garde practice for 1960s. And then so there's examples of her early work, and it does look, I mean, it's interesting to see it. It's work she did on her own, as I understand it. And there are things that look very like Kurt Switters, or that'd be the kind of region, there were assemblage type things in suitcases, and it almost has that kind of look of the 50s, the kind of color of everything. And then you get into, when it gets to the APG, you get tons of paper and photographs of meetings rather than objects, so there is quite a change. And then there's a huge a pretty big installation in the middle of the show where I'm not sure which of the guest artists worked on this, but lots of objects like bits of old bicycles and bits of, metal and stones. There's all these things that were apparently found alongside the Thames on the shore of the Thames, like Mark Dion before Mark Dion. And these are hanging from the ceiling, and coloured light and video is projected onto it. It's this kind of weird disco thing, almost. And I felt that wasn't really necessary, but I mean, I think of the archive because I've been reading my Derrida, and I mentioned that in the review. The archive is something that is it rem it's material that is remaining that can be reactivated. So you could contrast that with the museum. The museum is like a mausoleum where dead cultural objects reside, but things in the archive can be opened up and readdressed. And I think that's what the curators were doing by saying to three other artists, right, you come in and take the archive, take Stavini's physical legacy and do something with it. And in the gallery also, although I couldn't really listen into it, when I was walking around the gallery, there was a table with, I think they may have been art students, I'm not sure, but there was about 10 people around a table having a discussion. So that's, it's like they're reactivating, or the gallery has set up a possibility of debate within the gallery. But that kind of thing seemed very tokenistic, really, to me. But I mean, it is a, I mean, I'm not, I suppose my review is fairly critical of it. I think it's absolutely worth seeing the show, but I do think it tends too much towards the kind of stardom of one person, and that perhaps we should move on from that in museums and galleries, and especially with the practice that's influenced by Fluxus and other group things, which they acknowledge that they were. I mean, if you look at that again in the booklet, you get a sense of the members of the APG being in all sorts of different exhibitions in France and Germany, and where they set up a kind of mini discussion chamber or discussion room, and take the APG approach into other venues around Europe. So I'm losing my thread now, actually.
No,
But
it's an interesting
I think
point.
there's a lot you to go at. Sorry.
No, it's an interesting point, I think, about this idea of this more dispersed model and the way in which this exhibition, I guess you're right in pointing out, paradoxically places the artist back into the center, despite the fact that theoretically and conceptually it's about how we break apart those very ideas and ideals in an institution. But well, thanks, Peter, for that quick whistle stop tour around that exhibition. And as you point out, we certainly urge
Very rapid.
viewers to visit Modern Art Oxford and see this show for themselves, and to read Peter's article, which is in the current issue of Art Monthly.
Oh,
That,
sorry.
sorry, Peter. What did you want to say?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Well, I hope I'm not banned, you know, after all my criticisms from the museum. I
Never.
hope I'm not banned from the museum after being so critical of it.
I'm
But
sure
I
they
will
would never. Yeah, I'm sure they appreciate your comments.
Yeah.
I'm sure they
All
do.
right. Thanks, Chris.
No worries.
And now I'm joined by Elizabeth Fullerton.
Who has written an extensive report on the current art scene in Tallinn, Estonia, in this month's May issue, one which also explores past and current tensions with its neighboring country, Russia, but also explores the impact of colonial histories, the climate crisis, and the lives of indigenous people in the region. Elizabeth, I wondered if we could begin by talking about what led you to Tallinn, and have you been to the city before?
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me. No, it was my first visit, and so I was excited to go. I've been trying to get over there though for a while because I first came across a collective of curators from Estonia, from the CCA, which is the Estonian Centre for Contemporary Art. In 2023, when I went to Iceland, because they were curating the Iceland biennial sequences. So we'd got on really well, and I found it a really quite profound biennial, really, really interesting. The theme was can't see. So thinking about you know, what's deep under the earth, and of course Iceland is crazy beneath the earth, you know, all sorts of subterranean activity going on, and also yeah, things in the sky, in the cosmos, and you know, so the artists were really engaging it, you know, in sort of very cosmic way, and it was just a really interesting and well thought out biennial, and they'd been inviting me since then to try and come over to Tallinn. And I hadn't really found a good exhibition or a reason to do it. And then I was invited separately by Kumu Museum, as I happen to know, you know, a little bit, an artist called Ruth McLennan, who is British, who's a filmmaker, who was participating in it. And she thought I'd be interested in the themes of, because it's very much about bodies in the landscape and the way the landscape holds trauma and that sort of thing. So they invited me and I thought, brilliant.
Yeah. Talk about maybe some of the, as you sort of touched upon some of the themes in this show. Let's put them into more detail, because I think specifically they relate to obviously the area itself, so and to tell the history or the political history of the area. So maybe say something about that as well.
Yeah, so the theme of the Kumu exhibition, they began to talk, was started out from the premise of well, the curators had been talking to a Finnish environmental sociologist called Outi Ahti, and who's an academic and scholar, and she had had the experience of growing up next to a dam in Finland. And there was total silence about the dam. They all turned their backs on it. No one knew that it had once been one of the richest salmon rivers in Europe until the dam came along. And she didn't even know that her father had been a fisherman by trade. But there was just this silence in the village. So once she discovered that, she started thinking about the way landscape holds trauma and passes it down, you know, how this trauma is passed down through generations. And so that was kind of the starting point for the curators to think about silence and talking and how we can talk back. And maybe it's not always through verbal speaking, but through bodily or sensory speech or communication. And so that was very much in their thinking with the artists they chose. And I thought it was really interesting how the artists that they had picked were working with ideas about different languages, non-conventional languages, I guess, non-normative, non-patriarchal languages often, you know, and they also wanted to include indigenous artists. So along with Pia, there was also Uti Pieski, who's Sami, who did a story, who did a film, sorry, Here to Here, which was a sort of really jubilant dance performance by the two twin daughters of the artist. And that was a sort of definite reclaiming of space and voice. And so that was amazing. But also the curators included young Estonian artists working, trying to find different languages that, like Sasha Tishkov, who sort of created this weird installation of sort of wooden, wooden like axes and logs, but they had strange growths sprouting out of them and prickly spikes and oozing kind of materials. And, you know, so you were kind of could really imagine coming across that in a forest clearing and thinking, what kind of creature has been here and who's using that axe? And, you know, so it was, I think there was a queering of the landscape in those works a bit.
Okay. And that's just, and briefly about Ruth McLennan's film then, as that was partly why you were there. So it's kind of interesting maybe to unpack a little bit about her film. And it's good to see it because I remember her films, and I had to say I've not seen some for a while. So it's great to hear her name in a way. But could you say a little bit about her film?
Yeah, well, she, Ruth is a fluent Russian speaker, and she was invited to the really far flung corners. It's like way in the subarctic region. And she was exploring, she was filming there months, literally months before the invasion of Ukraine. And she was talking to communities about dying and lost traditions. And she, one thing that's really nice about the film is that she filmed several choirs, female choirs, and women talking about survival in those remote regions, and other people swapping stories, young people swapping stories. So they had mobile phones, but they're also talking about the importance of holding on to, some of them had written poems and stuff, so the importance of holding on to some of the rituals and traditions from the region. So there was really it felt like the forest was definitely a character in the film, and assumed, it was a sort of protagonist. And so it was really poignant to see this film after the invasion, with the knowledge that it was filmed, they would have known that there were troops massing on the border, but they probably didn't necessarily know that there was going to be this horrific attack that would, you know, be so have such impact on the region. And in Estonia, you definitely had the feeling of a huge shadow cast over the certainly the city of Tallinn. And people talking about it as the trauma that they had experienced since the invasion, because of course there's the sense that, you know, where is Putin stopping? Is he, you know, going to come back for us? Is he, you know, is he stopping with Ukraine or just going to carry on? So you really had this feeling of the vulnerability, and it is a small population. It's Tallinn itself is a small, compact city, very, very beautiful. Mishmash, as I said, of architectural styles. It's a very special place, but I was aware of that sense of risk and threat from the neighbour, enormous neighbour next door.
Do you want to talk a bit about the IKEA gallery, which was showing Carl Jonas Alamaz's work? That sounded quite interesting.
Oh, yes. That was really interesting. So that was a... I think that's quite a young gallery. I was told it was quite an academic one. It's and it was in a modern, it felt like it was in a, I don't know if it was, but a student block almost. It was on the ground floor. There was so much more to it. You know, it was so hard in such a small space to fit in, enough information, but it was interesting. Bread was a very prominent theme, and I've got here I in case I wanted to note it, but the reason it was called what was it, daily, let me just find it, because I wrote it, the show was called Daily Play and Bread, and the title came from an aphorism of the Roman poet Juvenal, give them bread and circuses and they will never revolt. Yeah. So that was the thinking behind it. So he'd built these enormous textile doughy kind of sculptures that were sort of stand-ins for people. They were very amorphic. And there were lots of screens, but there were also, there was a sort of what felt like one of those marble, trails that you put a marble in one end and it sort of, zags down. But instead you were doing that with a little bread piece. And then there was a shelf with interviews, mostly by the artists, I think, but with various people who had migrants who had come from different countries. So and not necessarily all to Estonia. There was, but they were very poignant tales. And so there was one I read from Palestine. One was from Ukraine. One was from Ghana, I think. And they were talking. He interviewed them about their, what bread meant in their lives. He sort of tied it all together. So I thought it was a really interesting, he's apparently quite a young upcoming artist in Carl Jonas Alama in Estonia. But yeah, so that was an interesting discovery. I really enjoyed that.
Interesting. And also there seemed to be quite a few shows, certainly was it the Artishok Biennial that were taking place in less conventional places in the city. Perhaps give us some examples of them, because they seem quite a sort of interesting way to explore. And it often is, we see a biennial and we're often pulled into various corners of the city that we normally wouldn't get to. So, and this seems to be very much in that lane as well.
Yes. And the curators had this year, apparently unlike previous years, they decided to slow everything down. So they staggered the openings of the 10 installations. So when I was there, there were only three open, I think. And one was a tour, so I couldn't have gone on it because it didn't coincide with my visit. So I went to one that was in an underground pedestrian passageway that once was really, really busy and apparently was connected to the Art Academy. But since there had been, I don't know, it, I can't remember why it became, it fell out of use a lot. So it was really hard to find the, especially for a foreigner, because a lot of the artists were very local and the works were very local. And, they were sort of like hidden gems that people knew about if you lived there. It took me a while to find this sort of, easily missed installation. And also because it was in this little sort of waiting room in this pedestrian tunnel, but a lot of the windows were papered over with these sort of these papers printed with events, art events from those sort of publicity papers for art events, which equally in the barely audible recording that was embedded in the door itself. He was reading out these memories of the art events that were listed on the paper. It was all really like obscure.
Well, thanks so much, Elizabeth, for this thorough roundup of Tallinn. I do urge listeners to check out her article in this current issue. Many thanks.
Thank you so much. All right.